This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Egal, ob Sie gerade erst beginnen oder Ihr Sicherheitsprogramm erweitern, herausragende Sicherheitspraktiken zu demonstrieren und Vertrauen aufzubauen, ist wichtiger denn je. Vanta automatisiert die Einhaltung von ISO 27001, SOC 2 und mehr, spart Ihnen Zeit und Geld und hilft Ihnen, das Vertrauen Ihrer Kunden zu stärken. Darüber hinaus können Sie Sicherheitsüberprüfungen vereinfachen, indem Sie Fragebögen automatisieren und die Sicherheit Ihrer IT-Infrastruktur mit einem kundenorientierten Trust Center demonstrieren. Über 9000 globale Unternehmen wie Atlassian, FloHealth und Koora nutzen Vanta bereits, um Risiken zu managen und Sicherheit in Echtzeit nachzuweisen. Erhalten Sie ein spezielles Angebot von $1000 Rabatt unter vanta.com/horen.
Hello, I'm James Kumarasamy. Thank you for downloading the BBC's World Tonight podcast for Tuesday, the 21st of January. On Donald Trump's first full day back in office, some of his supporters who were convicted for their role in the January the 6th riots have been leaving prison after the president issued a blanket pardon. We speak to one of those who's been pardoned and to a police officer who was defending the US Capitol building that day. We'll also look in more detail at Mr. Trump's plans for combating illegal immigration. We have an investigation into a far-right group, Patriotic Alternative, a nostalgic look at emo culture, and hear about the joys of a different kind of remote working in Antarctica. The violent scenes from the US Capitol riots that transfixed the world on January the 6th, 2021, also convinced most Americans that Donald Trump's time in politics was over. But now he is back in the White House, and President Trump has been as good as his word to his supporters who were criminally charged in connection with the attack on the Capitol building. At one of his Inauguration Day rallies, flanked by families of Israeli hostages being held by Hamas, he promised to bring what he called the J6 hostages home. And later on, with a stroke of his Sharpie, he made sure that would happen.
So this is January 6th, and these are the hostages, approximately 1,500 for a pardon.
Yes.
Full pardon.
Today, those homecomings began. Among those released from prison, the former leader of the far-right Proud Boys organization, Enrique Tarrio, he'd been sentenced to 22 years for seditious conspiracy following a four-month trial which found that he had organised the overthrow of the government. As he walked out of jail, he said he would resume political activity at his organisation's chapter in southern Florida after he was reunited with his family.
I want to fix some of the things that are going on down there in South Florida. I might take a step away from leadership right now from the Proud Boys organisation and focus on one. Number one, my God, my family, and then my club and my friends.
I've been speaking to one of the other people who have been pardoned. Brandon Strake was a pro-Trump influencer who pleaded guilty to disorderly conduct at the Capitol building on January the 6th and was sentenced to 3 years probation. He signed a statement saying that he told the crowd to go, 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 but he now says he was pressured to sign the confession. And he offered me his version of events.
I played the role of a pawn and a victim of the Biden Department of Justice. But to answer your question more specifically, I was a scheduled speaker at a permitted event on Capitol grounds that day. And when I started hearing from people that they were watching on the news and hearing that something was going on inside the Capitol, I then walked up to the building on the east side and started shooting a video so I could capture if anything was happening. And then I uploaded that video to Twitter. And 2.5 weeks later, I was raided by the FBI and thrown in jail.
That was you. That's your side of the story. What about the
well,
other side?
There's a video.
And there was an allegation that you had shouted, go, go, go.
I did say the words go, go, not go, go, go. I did say the words go, go. And that was to one individual in the crowd who responded to me because she was trying to push her way out of the crowd. And I said, go, go.
Right. There was violence, though. There were people who did attack police officers. There was a violent element to that whole day.
I can't speak to that because I didn't see it.
You've seen the videos, though, presumably.
I've seen videos of physical altercations between police and protesters. I am not going to sit here on your show and tell you that the protesters initiated the violence, because I've heard far too many stories from protesters who were attacked by police officers as they were standing there. And when they found themselves in a defensive posture, they were accused by the Department of Justice as initiating violence.
For those who did take part in the event and did initiate violence, is it right for them to be pardoned as well as you?
I don't condone initiating violence against police officers, and I don't condone breaking windows or doing property damage. That's not an appropriate or acceptable way for anybody to express themselves. However, we do have a justice system in this country that has to execute law in a way that's consistent and fair and balanced for all people. So we know that in numerous protests throughout American history, there have been times when protesters have, in much worse fashions, committed acts of violence against police officers or acts of destruction, including burning federal buildings to the ground. And these people were not treated the same way the January 6th protesters were treated.
But if someone has committed violence or caused damage, things that you are against, why completely exonerate them? Why not give them lighter sentences? Does that not undermine the law and order agenda that Donald Trump has?
No, because these people have been through enough. Everybody has been through enough. I mean, people's names, lives, finances, every aspect of their lives have been destroyed over this. It's more than enough. It's time to move on from this.
And, I mean, you're clear in your remarks that you believe the case against you and all those who were convicted in relation to January the 6th was a politically motivated one. You talk about the Biden Department of Justice. Is justice blind still in America?
Well, it certainly hasn't been for the last 4 years. And I hope that now we can begin the process of getting back to a point where nobody on either side of the political aisle ever has to live in fear that they may be treated the way that the January 6th defendants have been treated for the last 4 years.
That was Brandon Strake. Well, listening to that former U.S. Capitol Police officer who was on duty on January the 6th, 2021, Winston Panjon. Welcome to the program, Winston. I just wonder your reaction both to what you've heard and to the blanket pardons.
Yes, thank you for having me. Well, I mean, I'm glad to know that at least there is perhaps some common ground that those convicted of crimes on January 6th can say that violence against police is wrong. But to call themselves victims is just completely false. Those who were convicted were done so through the justice system by a jury of their peers and were sentenced accordingly. And largely, you know, of those 1,500 plus, you know, most of those people barely served any prison or jail time at all, you know, maybe 30 days, if that, but a lot of them didn't even serve anything at all. So to say that they've been treated unfairly is really just false, and it's not looking at the big picture and looking at the actual facts here.
And for the President of the United States to agree with them and to exonerate not just those who may have served hardly any time at all, but those who are due to serve 20 plus years in prison, what do you make of that?
I think that, you know, it's just so disrespectful. It is such a slap in the face. And to law enforcement, you know, to the Capitol Police especially, and to, you know, for all Americans to just think that those who committed violence, these violent felons, just aren't going to be held accountable for their actions. I understand, you know, I was a police officer for over 5 years. I know we all make mistakes. Nobody's perfect. But those who make mistakes, who commit these acts of violence, these criminal, you know, these crimes, they need to be held accountable. We need justice and law and order. And right now, we just don't have that anymore, it seems.
You think this is going to what undermine Americans' faith in law and order more broadly?
It sure seems like it. I mean, it's really this permission slip to these people. And, you know, now all of America and all the world can see that all of that violence, you know, is seemingly okay in the eyes of the now president. And it's really unfortunate that we are here because, again, you know, these officers made so many sacrifices that day and beyond. They continued, you know, to serve their communities and our country to do the right thing. And it's just so disrespectful.
You're talking about these officers. You, of course, were one of them. I just wonder what impact being there that day has had on you.
Well, it's had a very negative impact. I mean, I ended up leaving the department 10 months later, not only because of that, but certainly played a role in it. You know, I've received threats of violence and death to me online and, you know, since then. And it's just sad. You know, I like to think that had January 6th not happened, I would have still be with the Capitol Police because I really love my time there and I'm very thankful for all my experiences there. You know, it was my honor to serve.
Just briefly, I mean, you talk about threats. Do you think this decision to pardon those who are convicted makes that more likely?
It certainly seems like it because, again, you know, this just shows if you're loyal to the president, you can really do his bidding and seemingly without consequences.
Winston Pangeon, a former U.S. Capitol Police officer who was there on January the 6th, thanks very much. And later on in the program, we'll be hearing from a former director of the Immigration and Customs Enforcement to find out what he makes of President Trump's plans for mass deportations. And we'll also be speaking to our North America correspondent, Sarah Smith. And now let's turn to events in this country, as the Home Secretary gave more details today of the public inquiry into last year's Southport killings. She underlined the point that the Prime Minister had made earlier in the day when he spoke about a new threat. The profile of Axel Rudakabana, the 18-year-old who confessed on Monday to killing the three young girls and who had attempted to produce deadly ricin, called for a review of the state's approach to perpetrators who don't fit neatly into any categories. The people Sakir Starmer had called loners, misfits, young men in their bedrooms, drawn to extreme violence.
I am also asking the inquiry to consider the wider challenge of rising youth violence and extremism. Because I have been deeply disturbed at the number of cases involving teenagers drawn into extremism, serious violence and terrorism, including Islamist extremism, far-right extremism, mixed and confused ideology and the obsession with violence and gore.
Well, let's explore this with Stefan Bal, who's Professor of International Relations at Leuven University in Belgium, who's formerly from the University of Exeter. Good evening, Professor.
Good evening. Thank you for having me.
We heard there the Home Secretary talking about this apparent rise in the number of young people who are attracted to violence almost for its own sake. Is that a trend you have observed?
Yeah, I think there are many, actually a couple of trends here. So the first one is indeed a trend that is a growing concern from a whole range of law enforcement in across Europe and the United States, which is about younger and younger offenders. So there's a really a broad concern for teenage radicalization. But there's also another trend, which is kind of linked to that, which is a trend towards less and less ideological clarity in the offenders or the people referred for radicalization or terrorism offenses.
Why do you think that's happening?
I think I agree with what the UK independent reviewer of terrorism legislation, Jonathan Hall, has said earlier. I think one of the main you have a series of dynamics that relate to the internet, and I think that's really a key issue. So we can explore that if you want.
Yes, but when you're saying that there aren't ideologies behind these, what about the motivations, though? If you can't pin certain ideologies on the perpetrators, what about the motivations?
Yeah, it's a very complex issue. In many cases, this involves some psychological issues, psychiatric issues sometimes, and sometimes it's also a pure product of engagement with a series of milieus on the internet, and so the fact that people, you know, go more and more online, and then they find some extremist content, and then they find some places dedicated to school shootings, for example, to extreme violence.
And what
they
what,
do a mishmash.
And what sort of milieus are you talking about?
Well, so there are many things that you find online. You have, of course, a really massive extremist environment on the internet nowadays. It's been growing steadily over the past 10, 15 years, but you also have other stuff that you find on the internet, like, you know, how to print weapons, how to, you know, as in this case, how to create poison, how to kill people. So you have really have a big problem with the internet in the sense that you have a lot of problematic content that has gone unchecked and that has grown quite widely over the past, let's say, five, six years.
So to counter this, where should the government, do you think, be concentrating its efforts?
It's a very hard question because the problem is a little bit out of control. To be honest, the size of the structures that we find online, both extremist and non-extremist or borderline extremist, is really big and is going to grow. It's going to continue growing. I think that the key is to really better understand the exact structures and the dynamics of these parts of the internet, and to identify these dynamics, the people who play a role in these, and to really target what are the key dynamics and the key individuals playing a role in this extension.
Well, look, thank you very much for that, Stefan Bell, Professor of International Relations at Louvain University in Belgium. Now, how far would you go to get a job? No, really, how far would you go? Well, if the answer is a long way, you might be tempted by an advert that's calling for carpenters, chefs, electricians, plumbers and a lot more to work for the British Antarctic Survey at one of its research stations in Antarctica. They are promised an experience of a lifetime. So what's that experience like? Well, we can speak to someone who can tell us now. Emma Pierce, she's a glaciologist who is currently working at the Halley 6 research station in Antarctica. That's nearly 9,000 miles away from home. And she joins us live from there. Emma, good afternoon, evening. I'm not sure where it is with you.
it's good evening for me. I've just had dinner.
Lovely. Well, look, thank you so much. Well, may I ask, what sort of food do you have in Antarctica to start with?
Oh, well, we have a wonderful chef. So everything we eat is really tasty, but all sort of starts out dehydrated. So we don't have much fresh food, but the chef here is able to make a wonderful dinner. So tonight we had noodles and ramen.
Wow. Well, very, very non-Antarctic by the sound of things. But look, you're sitting there after dinner. I mean, perhaps describe for our listeners what the surroundings are like.
So I'm currently sitting looking out the window, and in front of me, I can see some skidoos, which are our little vehicles that we use to drive around on the ice. And then as far as I can see, it's flat and white with beautiful blue skies because it's 24-hour daylight here. So although it's evening, it's not dark at all.
Ah, so my first question about whether it was evening or afternoon, the answer is both.
Yeah, it's light all the time, so it doesn't matter.
Well, great. Well, look, obviously for someone like you, it's the place to be. But for the chefs you talked about who've been rustling up the noodles for you and the electricians and plumbers that are the subject of this advert, what do you think the appeal is of being down there?
It's the magic. As soon as you step off the plane, when you arrive in Antarctica, there's nowhere else like it. It takes your breath away. It's quiet and beautiful and a really special place to be. And it's a community. It's a sense of family that you just don't get anywhere else. You don't get it with any other sort of job. It's a really, really special place. And it's nice to all be working towards the same project and trying to understand what's going on in Antarctica.
Community, I guess, and there must be tensions. You're probably not going to reveal them live on air, but you know, I guess you have to get on pretty well, given that you are remote working in such a literal way.
I think it's remarkable that the people who want to come to Antarctica, we are all very like-minded people and all very similar people.
Well, how would you describe that that mindset?
Someone who wants a sense of adventure, but a sense of community and just someone who wants to be able to experience something that other people often don't get to experience.
Well, it's an amazing experience. Thanks so much for joining us. Hopefully the fact that we can communicate with you means that you're not too lonely there. You can still keep in touch.
Yes, no, we have 30 people on station. We have internet. We have Netflix and TV. We have all sorts of things. So
just like being at home. Well, look, it's lovely to talk to you, Emma. Many, many thanks for joining us live there, Emma Pierce in Antarctica. And a quick reminder, if you want to listen back to any of this programme or to previous ones, you can go to BBC Sounds, where you can also download the podcast. The main headlines so far in the world tonight. A number of people who were jailed for their participation in the Capitol riots in the United States have been released from prison on day two of Donald Trump's presidency. The Prime Minister has warned Britain that terrorism has changed as he addressed the failures that led to the Southport stabbings. And Israeli security forces have launched what's been called an operation to eradicate terrorism in the occupied West Bank. Now let's head back to the United States and another policy area where Donald Trump has been pretty quick out of the blocks, immigration. Last night we heard from the US-Mexico border after the newly reinstalled US president signed a raft of executive orders and decrees aimed at cracking down on people who enter the country illegally. Well, some of those measures are likely to face significant hurdles. And today, 22 states filed lawsuits against an order which denies US citizenship to babies born on American soil to illegal immigrants. Separately, the Trump administration has closed off one app-based legal pathway to claiming asylum and has ordered ICE, that's the body which carries out immigration arrests, to ignore Biden-era advice not to detain people near sensitive areas like churches, schools and hospitals. Well, John Sandweg was an acting director of ICE under President Obama, and I asked him what it would take for President Trump to deport what he has said would be millions of immigrants in his second term.
In his first term, he came nowhere near the kind of levels of deportations he's talking about now. You know, during his last full year prior to COVID, the agency deported less than 250,000 individuals, a fraction of the kind of numbers he's talking about now. So in order for him to pull this off, I think there are two primary challenges he faces. One is the resources available to ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, the lead deportation agency, and two is the backlogs we have in our immigration courts. Of the 11 to 12 million undocumented immigrants who live here, the majority of them cannot be deported until a judge issues a final order of deportation, right? And the courts have been historically underfunded by the U.S. Congress, so there are always backlogs to where somebody gets arrested by ICE. It takes 2 years or so before they have their hearing. We now have 900 immigration judges looking at 3 million cases. So if Trump has any hope of making mass deportations, he has to figure out a way to either surge resources into the courts so you can catch up on that backlog, or figure out a way to bypass the courts altogether. And I think he is, not surprisingly, seizing on the idea of bypassing the courts. So in those executive orders last night, buried in there, we saw that he is anticipating invoking a 1793, I believe it is, law called the Alien Enemies Act. And what that would say is that basically he's made a declaration that we are under a foreign invasion, as he calls it, at the border, and that because it's a foreign invasion, he can unilaterally and without any court approval detain and deport migrants.
But presumably that is open to legal challenges.
Absolutely open to legal challenges. Now, this is, of course, a law that was famously and infamously, I should say, used by the United States to detain Japanese Americans during World War II after the attack on Pearl Harbor. The question will be the situation at the border. Does that constitute an invasion? And then two would be a legitimate other question, though, is courts in America are generally reluctant to second-guess the president when it comes to matters of national security and foreign policy. So that is working in his favor, although I think any court would look, you know, probably very suspiciously at the idea that this constitutes a foreign invasion.
And calling it a foreign invasion, does that make it easier and more legitimate in the eyes of the law to use the military to enforce it?
Yes, absolutely. By declaring this a foreign invasion, what he's trying to do is get authorization, not just to use military resources, but to use them in a way that's never been used in the United States before. And so historically, during President Obama's time, President Bush's time, we have called on the National Guard to support the Department of Homeland Security, to support civil law enforcement by providing additional surveillance capabilities. But they would be limited. They would not ever make an arrest, and they would just watch for migrants and report activity at the border.
I mean, there are laws which limit the use of federal troops for what's considered to be domestic policing.
Absolutely. The Posse Comitatus Act has historically prevented military from engaging in civil law enforcement in the United States. So I think what Trump is trying to do, though, and what's very clear from these executive orders, is he's contemplating a hands-on role for the military. He's asking the military to build detention camps inside military bases to support his mass deportation effort. He's asking the military to provide transportation planes to fly migrants back to their home country. And he's asking NORTHCOM to build a plan to seal, quote-unquote, seal the border. And he's not in that executive order, he's not asking them to do this so in support of the Department of Homeland Security, but rather to take operational responsibility themselves. So certainly he's contemplating a use of a military like we have never seen in the history of the United States at our border.
And that was John Sandwig, former acting director of ICE, the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement. Well, let's cross now to Sarah Smith, our North America editor, who is in Washington for us. Sarah, so day two of the second Trump term, the administration says it's beginning to work on those immigration plans. Just tell us a bit more about that, the reaction to it, and, well, what else Donald Trump's announced?
Yeah, well, we're waiting to see some of the much anticipated raids on illegal immigrants coming. We heard from Trump's border czar, Tom Holman, that they are definitely planning to do this in what he calls sanctuary cities. That's basically Democrat-run cities where undocumented migrants and asylum seekers have been welcomed, places like New York or Chicago, San Francisco, where we know they're planning early to go and try and round up as many undocumented migrants as they can find to show that Donald Trump's policy is being put into action. There's no evidence that that's happened yet, but the border czar says they are working on it imminently, as I say, so I imagine we'll see that reasonably soon. And of course, it's all part of Donald Trump trying to demonstrate that he really is delivering on the things that he promised his supporters. He's sending out emails to them saying, look at the long list of promises that I made that are now promises kept. And it's quite important, I think, to discern between that. What are showy announcements that he can make, in which you might include, say, for instance, pardoning all the January the 6th rioters, which is answering something that his supporters very much wanted him to do, but not making a material change to America. And then other things which it'll take much longer to bring in, like, you know, really significant changes on the border, which he can't claim success on yet, even if he says he's achieved what he wanted to.
Yeah, and I'm looking at images of him now. He's involved now in this launching what he's called the Stargate AI project, $500 billion plus in investments, and a lot of the great and the good of the tech world are there with him.
Yes, he's got tech CEOs stood beside him in the White House as he's making this first announcement from the White House just 24 hours into his premiership. And, of course, he loves this announcing, you know, large amounts of cash from private industry going in to build American infrastructure because he wants them to be at the forefront of AI. Well, doesn't every premier want their country to be at the forefront of AI? But he's able to say that large amounts of cash are going into this as well. So he's spreading his announcements as far and wide as he can, from things like saying that he's gotten rid of transgender ideology, as he calls it, from the federal government to, as you say, investing hundreds of billions of dollars.
Yes, and I mean, states have been ready for all of this, haven't they, in particular on immigration, and quite a group of them have already been filing lawsuits in response to that decree about Americans or babies born on American soil to those without documents.
Yeah, and that's going to be the first of a lot of legal challenges you'll see against some of the things that Donald Trump has already signed. But you're absolutely right. Birthright citizenship, as it's called, is one of the first challenges that's been brought in several different states, actually, across America. Because he thinks that by signing an executive order, he can stop a child that's born in America automatically being able to claim U.S. citizenship. But it's written in the Constitution that you can become a citizen in those circumstances. So he thinks that you know, he might be able to find a way around that, but that's going to be tested in the courts and likely all the way up to the Supreme Court before he can actually say he's achieved something on that one.
Sarah, many thanks. Our North America editor, Sarah Smith, there. Back to this country now, and there have been calls for the far-right group Patriotic Alternative to be banned after an undercover BBC investigation exposed extreme racist views among some of its supporters and members. Posing as a new recruit, a BBC journalist recorded PA supporters calling for migrants to be killed if they refuse to leave the UK. Wira Davis reports.
Take in turns to carry the big banners.
Patriotic Alternative says it campaigns for the rights of Indigenous British people and is neither extremist nor racist. It organises social events like hikes in the Peak District, on which Patrick, a former history teacher, compared PA's tactics now to how Hitler and the Nazis came to power.
If you look at what the National Socialist Party did in Germany after the Führer was released from Landsberg prison, is they were doing community organising. They were talking to local people about local issues, not as politicians. And that was what paved the way for them skyrocketing through the elections from 1929 onwards.
A BBC journalist spent months undercover with PA, recording conversations and the views of members like Aaron.
They're going to exterminate us, destroy our country, our people and our families, and call us racist. Or we can stand up to them and they're still going to call us racist. You've got two choices. Fight or die.
Aaron later told our journalist, while working together on a decorating job, what he thinks should be done with migrants.
We put them all in the camps until they agree to leave, and if they refuse, we shoot them. And that's the end of it. It's the only way they'll leave. It's the only way we can keep this country ours.
Our investigation exposes how members of this far right-wing group want new recruits to join what they call a race war on our streets. How they ask for cash to bankroll convicted racists, and how they peddle misinformation online and in communities to sow division. Accused of exploiting genuine local concerns over plans to bring migrants to a hotel in Llanelli, or the violent scenes that followed the murders of three young girls in Southport, PA insists their campaigns are peaceful, within the law, and they have a code of conduct. But Nigel Bromage, who's a former neo-Nazi activist himself and is now helping to de-radicalise people, including former members of PA, says their tactics are quite insidious.
PA is a big organisation. It's been the number one far-right organisation now for a number of years. Anybody who's got a need or susceptibility, they'll bring in. They'll make them feel valuable. It's the most effective that it's ever been. You know, they offer the best wraparound service you can get. But the fact they have active branches in most parts of the UK should really, really be concerning to all of us.
We found numerous cases of PA members or their supporters using the most extreme language and views. At the annual conference, we heard a guest speaker saying that the only way to deal with non-white criminals is literally skinning them and hanging their bodies from traffic lights. All of the members we contacted with our questions either didn't answer us or denied any wrongdoing. And one accused the BBC of having an anti-white bias.
They may not engage in terrorism, but are they creating a climate that's conducive to it? I would argue yes. Are they creating a climate for violence, hate crime? Yes.
Dame Sarah Khan was Britain's first counter-extremism commissioner. She's called for new laws to ban groups like PA.
So I think we need hateful extremism prescription orders to outlaw those organisations. I think we need legislation to criminalise the leaders of these organisations because I don't believe they can be de-radicalised.
And are you making these points to the current government?
I am making them to the government and I will continue to do so.
The last government described Patriotic Alternative as akin to being a neo-Nazi white supremacist organisation. The current Home Office says extremism has no place in our society. For now, PA is still allowed to operate and campaign within the law. But for how long?
Wira Davis reporting, and you can watch the full documentary called Unmasked Extreme Far Right on iPlayer. There's also a podcast version on BBC Sounds. Emo culture may have never quite gone mainstream, but that feels on brand. For the uninitiated, it's a subculture of music and fashion for the angsty outsider that peaked in the 2000s. It features dark clothes, dark makeup, and a dark mood. And it is the subject of an exhibition at the moment at London's Barbican Centre. And I was shown around by its curator, Jamie Brett.
He said, son, when you grow up, would you be the saviour?
My name's Jamie and I'm creative director at the Museum of Youth Culture. So we've been invited to put on this exhibition and it's called I'm Not Okay, and it's an emo retrospective 2004 to 2009.
How do you define it?
It's a scene where people had a very specific hair. It's like dark hair. It's got influences of like goth and punk and hardcore as well. It definitely was a sort of result of collective sort of trauma and public, the sort of psyche of the public at the time. 9/11, the war in Iraq, where the future was looking really bleak for young people. We didn't know what it was going to actually look like. And I think even the way that we dressed and the way that we communicated online, we couldn't see a future for ourselves other than through this sort of guise of being emo. Emo was the only way we could see our future.
Perhaps we can have a look at the exhibit over here.
Yeah,
it's got some nice artefacts, hasn't it?
Yeah, it has, yeah. It was a very tactile time. Although it was digital, it was one foot in online and one foot in real life. We've got some albums here that are really iconic, System of a Down to Paramore, and they're those CD cassettes. And we've also got a games console, because games are really a big part of that. So with a Nintendo DS, with the customised beads and the way that people would express themselves and put their like their little trinkets on things. This was the first generation where we started to get the camera phone and the polyphonic ringtones. And, you know, you spend hours trying to convert your song onto a polyphonic ringtone.
I remember that, downloading them.
First generation iPod there.
We started this all with 1,000 songs in your pocket, right? We started it with the original iPod.
Having a separate device to listen to music on.
It already feels old, doesn't it?
It's got a quite dark collection of objects. SpongeBob seems to be smiling at us, though.
We kind of had this like ironic cute thing where it'd be like, you know, Hello Kitty and SpongeBob would be alongside wearing all black. So it was semi-ironic.
People who've been visiting this exhibition have been leaving little notes, and I think you're quite touched by them.
What's been really interesting is instead of just getting like drawings and handwritten things, we've been getting people's website screenshots. People have saved their HTML code from their MySpace pages, and then they've tried to open them back up on their computer, or they've got a screenshot of it.
I wonder if some of the visitors would care to join us. You're here to see the exhibition.
Yeah.
What does it mean to you?
Emo doesn't define anything, just a way that people tried to put you into a box. I'm not sure how it was in the UK, but in Portugal there wasn't a lot. And the ones that were, we were very bullied at school because we were seen as a bit different.
But the culture, the music, the look, it's you, it's something you embrace.
Oh yeah, definitely. I mean, it's been, 20 years now and I still dress the same as when I was 17.
Inside, deep down, you're still...
Still an emo, oh god, yeah. I'm still into you. I should be over all the butterflies.
And all the people I knew and the bands I listened to. And it was just such a like a little microcosm of culture. So it's so bizarre listening and reading about other people who are living the same life I live. Because when you were there, in your friendship group, you were the only one. The longevity you see in rock and metal and emo doesn't exist in pop culture music, other than the massive icons, who are icons because there aren't that many of them. Whereas like I'm still going to see the same bands that I saw 20 years ago, and none of my friends can say that. So I think that's testament enough, really.
Emo lives on.
Emo lives on, 100%.
Emo forever.
Some memories of emo culture there by some elder emos, is one of them. The last one we heard from there called herself, and that exhibition at the Barbican is on until February the 7th. Just time for our closing headline tonight. A number of people have been pardoned by President Trump for their part in the attack on the US Capitol in 2021 have begun leaving prison, including several leading members of far-right groups. Mr. Trump signed orders wiping away convictions of more than 1,200 individuals, some jailed for violent crimes, and instructed his Justice Department to halt hundreds of other cases. On the front pages tomorrow, another item we featured tonight, The Guardian leading with PM's pledge to overhaul terror laws amid tidal wave of online violence. The Sun also focuses on Axel Rudakabana, labelling him the Amazon killer, a reference to the fact he was about to buy a knife from that website at the age of 17 and with a history of violence. The Daily Mail goes with some economic news. Reeves hit by biggest job slump since COVID. That is The World Tonight. This is James Kamara-Sami. I'll be back tomorrow at 10. But for now, from me and everyone on the programme, good night.
Studio direction was by Holly Palmer and the editor this evening, Matthew Symington.
Yoga is more than just exercise. It's the spiritual practice that millions swear by. And in 2017, Miranda, a university tutor from London, joins a yoga school that promises profound transformation.
It felt a really safe and welcoming space. After the yoga classes, I felt amazing.
But soon, that calm, welcoming atmosphere leads to something far darker, a journey that leads to allegations of grooming, trafficking and exploitation across international borders.
I don't have my passport, I don't have my phone, I don't have my bank cards, I have nothing.
The passport being taken, the being in a house and not feeling like they can leave.
World of Secrets is where untold stories are unveiled and hidden realities are exposed. In this new series, we're confronting the dark side of the wellness industry, where the hope of a spiritual breakthrough gives way to disturbing accusations.
You just get sucked in so gradually, and it's done so skillfully that you don't realise.
And it's like this, the secret that's there. I wanted to believe that, you know, that whatever they were doing, even if it seemed gross to me, was for some spiritual reason that I couldn't yet understand.
Revealing the hidden secrets of a global yoga network.
I feel that I have no other choice. The only thing I can do is to speak about this and to put my reputation and everything else on the line. I want truth and justice. And for other people to not be hurt, for things to be different in the future.
To bring it into the light and almost alchemize some of that evil stuff that went on. And take back the power.
World of Secrets, Season 6, The Bad Guru. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.